So if you just joined us, welcome. My name is Justin Bader with the Principles Center, and this is our February roundtable meeting. We're honored to be joined today by Ken Williams. How are you doing today, Ken?
All good. Doing great, man. How about you?
Good. Very excited to talk about the book, re-listen to the podcast. I know many of our members listened to the podcast interview that we did previously about starting a movement. So we're not going to necessarily rehash that podcast. That's there for people to listen to at their convenience. But I'm so grateful for the opportunity today to talk with you, Ken, and to get your insights on the culture work that schools do to truly start a movement, to truly become a professional learning community. And I'm excited to have the opportunity for our panelists to share their problems of practice here in this setting. And by the way, if you're just joining us as an attendee, we do see you as a panelist. This is the roundtable, and you're welcome to comment in the chat at any time. And if you would like to come on camera and ask your question out loud and be able to provide context and nuance to your question that way, I would love for you to do that. Just let me know in the chat so I don't surprise you by putting you on camera. We don't like to put people on the spot here, but we do like to give people the hot seat if they would like it. So, Ken, I wonder if we could start by just having you share a little bit with us about what specific role you play in helping schools become professional learning communities. Because I think, you know, as I read the book and as you reference the work of, you know, many of our colleagues, whether the, you know, talking about the Dufours or Anthony Muhammad or Mike Mattos or other colleagues who have been architecting this work over the years, often there are some predictable problems. We know as a community, a learning community, we're going to encounter certain problems. And I so appreciate your way of framing and challenging those problems. What do people call you about, Ken?
I appreciate that, man. Thank you. I get called often. I can give you the phraseology. It's pretty much this: we've been doing PLC for several years, and I know there's been a lot of effort, a lot of time and energy invested, but they know deep down they're not getting the results they want, the student learning results. And after a while, just to sleep easy, we start counting folks going to meeting as results. And, you know, we're filling out this paperwork as results. But ultimately, what I do when I'm called in, my mission is to make the work as simple to understand as possible and as organic as possible. And once you have an organic understanding of what this thing is, all the moving parts make more sense. I find a lot of schools, the PLC process got a lot of moving parts, and sometimes we attack those parts in isolation. And when we attack them in isolation, they lack context, you know? And so, you know, doing common formative assessment work feels like more of a chore than it is a piece of a puzzle. Separating RTI from the rest of the process seems more like a puzzle. But here's what it comes down to. Every learning endeavor has essential learnings. Every learning endeavor does. If we felt like every student had to walk out of our classroom knowing how to make this 20-ounce coffee cup, and there are 12 steps, 12 essential steps to making this cup, then our work as a PLC would be to figure out how we're going to ensure every student walks out with those 12. How do we organize around that? And so every course and every content area has essentials. Let's figure out what in those essentials every student must know and be able to do, and how do we organize around doing it? That's the work. So that's the work. And so once you understand that's the work, then everything else will make sense.
Yeah, and you talk often about going from compliance to commitment. And I think sometimes we feel like, well, I would settle for compliance some days, like just getting to compliance would be progress sometimes. But what really constitutes that difference when we see a team really, or a whole staff really internalizing that commitment to take responsibility for student learning? What shifts? What does it look like?
So there are two distinct types of compliance. Now, one we welcome. when we welcome, when we want to be cautious with. So the compliance of trudging into new learning, doing a common assessment protocol for a first time, learning about the PLC process, it's going to feel pretty literal, you know, when you got the manual right here and you're reading and then you try something and you're reading and then you try something. It's not a part of your DNA yet. That part of compliance is fine. That's part of all new learning. You know, whatever it is we endeavor in, I drive really old cars and it's hard for me to find mechanics to fix them. And so I'm forced to learn how to do things. And a lot of it feels mechanical in the beginning. That compliance we welcome as long as we move on. You know, I started tuning up my car. It was super mechanical, made a lot of mistakes early on. I'm much better at it now because I kept working at it. The compliance we want to avoid is the compliance that comes with the absence of the why. So there's the commitment to the why, like why we're doing this, what is our mission? That compliance we want to be careful of. And so that's when schools dive into the PLC process without a compelling why. And the PLC process is not your why. I've not met a teacher yet that says, oh my God, I can't wait to get out of bed and do PLC. Nobody says that. But when I come to your school and the first major activity we do is answering this question. And this is a question, ironically, Mike Maddox, I heard ask this question in a keynote back in 2014, and I've made it a part of my practice since. And the question is, what do you want school to provide your child? And if you're not a parent, you think about a child so special in your life, you can use that child as a prism. And what I have staff do is think about that question, and they got to answer it in one sentence. And Justin, I'm telling you, I don't care whether the audience is welcoming, whether it's full of curmudgeon-y people, whether, you know, it's a warm environment or an environment where people are just like this, waiting to see what you're going to offer. When I ask that question and they answer it in one sentence, it is a home run. It levels the field. Every single person, I've asked more than 50,000 teachers and leaders this question, and it's always, their answers are always in the context of learning for all. I want my child to be loved and challenged. I want rigor. I want them to be ready to take on the world. I want teachers who care about them and see them. I want them to be able to problem solve, learn how to fail, get back up, you know, all those things, right? And so what we want to do is build commitment around the general idea of all those things. And that becomes our why. Like if you and our audience takes a moment after we're done and answer that question in one sentence, I promise you, you're going to bleed on that paper. When you think about your kids, you're going to bleed on that paper. That's what gets us out of bed. And so as a staff, we do a mashup of all those comments. We figure out what our statement is, every child, every day, and this we believe, success for every student. That's our why, right? And that's the thing that helps us move through the compliance part of things, right? So when we're committed to something, when you first started your website, we talked. So much stuff is super automated now, but when you started it, man, you were piecing things together like insane piecemeal. If you didn't have a commitment to a why, the first, second, or third time you got kicked in the mouth with some tech problem would have done you in. I know that, you know, the product you have now is not the result of you flipping a switch and it's just happening, right? I've been around, like I'm watching you build that thing. And so that's how we move past the initial compliance of beginning the process. We got to have consensus around the why, like why we're doing this. And what I do is I take staff from figuring out what we want for our kids and kids we love to what do we want for other people's kids. And then once they realize, and right away, they're like, we want the same. And then we figure out how to bridge the gap. That's the why that moves us past the compliance of just doing this because it's one more thing to do, if that makes sense. So the compliance of new learning, we welcome, as long as we got a plan to move on from it, right? But the compliance of the absence of a why, that's the dangerous part. That's the part we gotta avoid. And I know schools are super busy, but we gotta make time to rally around that wine. It doesn't mean you need to take 8 months on a mission statement. That's not what I'm talking about. You can do this in 3 hours, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Sorry, well, get me lit up.
No, yeah, that's, hey, that's what we're here for, right? That's that's what we bought a ticket for, to get lit up a little bit by a lit up Ken Williams. So I love so much of what you said there. And I want to ask our panelists here, everyone who is joining live, to please pop in with your questions. If you want to get on camera and ask a question, just let me know in the chat and we can make that happen. I just have one more question before we turn it over to our panel. If we could talk a little bit about the difference between a mission statement and a mantra, because I think we've probably all worked in schools that have this mission statement that's like a solid paragraph of text, you know, 60, 70, 80, 100 words, and it made everybody on the committee happy. It covered everybody's priorities. Nobody really has it memorized, and really it's kind of the, you know, least common denominator rather than something that really drives us and focuses us. Talk to us about a mantra versus a mission statement.
Well, everyone at this moment is going to know that this recording, this live programming is completely authentic and genuine, because that's a great question. But in the spirit of authenticity and complete transparency, if you've written a book, here's what happens. As soon as it's published, you feel super proud. A month later, there are parts of it you're going to want to revise. You're like, oh, I'm even better now at this, you know? And so the work around the mantra that we talk about in our book was an effort to try to cut down on this super cumbersome mission statement process. Rather than, like you said, try to write a statement that means everything to everyone, let's get it down to something short and sweet and quick, right? Now, that's a step in the right direction. But if I had to do it all over again, I can go back to 2015, 16, when we wrote that book, I would say something different now. It really isn't about the statement. It isn't about the mantra or the mission statement. Rick DeFore used to tell us, God rest his soul, he used to tell us, if your mission statement doesn't change the way you teach and the way you lead, it's useless. And what that made me know is this, and this is what I bang the drum on when I work with schools and districts and coach principals. It's not about the mission statement. It's about the mission you're on. Answer this question: what mission are we on? And let me make it easy for you. Are we learning for all or learning for some? If we're learning for all, come up with a quick phrase that, you know, makes you happy, talks about your school. What, for us, it was every child, every day. Whatever you want to come up with. When I ask that question, what do you want school to provide your child? I promise you every answer sounds like learning for all. So let's just figure out what phrase you want to use. Let's get that done quickly. And that can be a mantra. The real work where we want to pour our energy into is, what collective commitments drive the mission we're on? It's not about the mission statement, and it's not about the mantra. It really isn't, unless those things are part of what drives our work. So Nike, everybody knows, I ask them all the time, like, what's Nike's? Just do it, right? But we know they didn't build a company by saying, hey, I got this idea, Phil Knight, I got this idea. Let's go with just do it now. Let's go build something big. No, they took just do it and went to every group, every department and said, let's talk about what just do it means in this department. Let's talk about what just do it, what are the commitments in this department, in the sales department, in the department that makes the rubber soles. And so the real work, I don't want our audience spending tons of time on mission statements and mantras, because the real work is, now that we got the statement, what are the handful of commitments we all agree to execute in the service of this work? And that's ultimately where we miss in schools. We spend all our time on the statement. We got much more statement than mission. We spend all our time wordsmithing, when the real work is, what are the commitments? Are we going to commit to a collaborative culture? Are we going to commit to every course and content area identifying essential learning targets? Are we going to commit to treating those targets like they're essential? Are we going to commit to taking action on real-time data to figure out which instructional practices were most effective and which students need more help and which students need extension and enrichment. Will we commit to those things? That's the real work. And I would have more of that content in if I did a second edition of this book than even the mantra. But the mantra moves us in the right direction. We don't want to spend 7 months putting together a statement. The statement means nothing without the commitment. With the commitments, go for all the statements you want, make all the spirit where you want, I'm all for it. But it really is, if you answer the question, what mission are we on? It's going to take care of everything.
Very well said. Very well said. So I'm looking at who is in the room with us today. And by the way, if you are joining live, please let me know what you would like to ask. I'd be happy to put you on the hot seat if you would like, and get a chance to ask Ken your question in person. But I'm noticing how many people on here are superintendents, assistant superintendents, and thinking about a district context where there is a district mission. There, you know, there's some sort of probably fairly concise, I think these things tend to be more concise at the district level, you know, some sort of concise mission that has been articulated. And yet the challenge of getting every school, every principal, every school leadership team invested and enlisted in that mission, you know, obviously is a big one. It's why we have assistant superintendents. It's why we have the layers of leadership that we need to coordinate that work across many different campuses. So as you've seen schools become committed, shift from that compliance to that commitment, and really get invested in a commitment and a mission to helping all students learn, talk to us a little bit about the you know, the activation of a kind of off mission sector, right? So I think anybody who supervises multiple schools can attest that, you know, you have some schools where you just feel like they're firing on all cylinders, they're aligned, everyone is fully committed, and you have other schools where it almost feels like an accidental collection of people who ended up in a building together rather than really a team, rather than a staff that has that collective commitment. Help us out with that at the district level. If we have a school that just feels like it's not, you know, that commitment is not there.
Yeah. So one of the things you mentioned, and one of the things you mentioned were layers of leadership. And one of my colleagues and friends, Tom Maney, he wrote a book, I believe it's Leverage, or can't exactly remember the name, but he talked about cascading leadership. And so if we start with the classroom teacher, her students, that's her classroom. Like she's got to make sure that everyone is engaged in the right practice so they can learn, right? And just like everything else, she's got pockets of kids who make it happen, pockets of kids who come to school ready to go, pockets that don't want to get all that. Then you got the principal, right? The principal's classroom are the teachers, right? And so those teams, the principal, he or she's got to make sure the teams are making it happen. You're going to have pockets of teams that are making it happen, pockets that aren't, pockets you got to sit on, pockets that are hot mess express, all that stuff. At the district level, when you look at cascading leadership, the district level, their classroom, the assistant soup's classroom, are the principals. And so their primary focus should be to leverage their expertise to support principals, right? And the best way to do it, and this is not talked about enough, it's largely ignored. We talk so much about the norm of teacher isolation, but that's almost a thing of the past. It really is. Our challenge now is to make sure teachers are collaborating effectively. The real issue right now is principal isolation. And if I had a magic wand, when I work with districts and we do some long-term work and can see some things through, one of the first things we do is we organize their principals into collaborative teams. Principals and teams, let's say you got a district with 12 schools, I'm going to have them divide up into either teams of three or teams of four. And those principals are going to walk through the same process that teachers walk through. We have teachers collaborate because we know fourth grade teachers get better when they collaborate effectively with fourth grade teachers, right? And we know that no one teacher has all the answers to unlock student learning. No one teacher can teach all kids. And so our best chance of ensuring learning for every child is to have people collaborate. Well, it's the same with principals. You got principals who are better with, you know, attention to detail, organization than others. You got some that are better at confronting issues than others. You got some that are better at, you know, sequential planning than others. You got some better at people skills than others. And so we've got to get our principals together. And what they do is they answer the four questions, you know, so our assistant soups then would answer the four questions of a learning community. What do we expect principals to know? How do we know when principals have learned it? How do we respond when principals haven't learned it? And how do we respond when principals don't know it? And so when I work with collaborative teams at schools of teachers, we've got these milestones. You know, we've got to get our norms done. We've got to make sure our why is in place. We've got to make sure we've got our essential targets identified. We got to make sure we have kind of a scope and sequence of how we're going to teach it so we can be there for one another, common assessment, all those things. Principals should have the same milestones and be working in teams to make that happen. And so the best examples I see of this is when principals come, when the superintendent or assistant supes bring principals together, they're working in collaborative. It's more than administrivia. There is time for them to work in collaborative teams the way we want teachers to work in collaborative teams. Because there's only one person in the schoolhouse who can make sure that people behave with fidelity, and that's the principal. And so the district should act as, you know, as the teacher for the principals, providing them support, providing resources, but don't treat them like a lot of schools treat teachers, which is we're gonna improve teachers one at a time with observations. Observations are fine, walkthroughs are fine, but nothing's more powerful than when teachers are organized and job-alike teams answering the right questions. And it's the same for principals. You get principals together and you set some milestones like, hey, all four of our schools, we're gonna have norms in place and every team's gonna identify essential learning targets by this date. And then you check in with each other. Who's making progress and how is that happening? What are you doing there? And what'd you hand out? Well, my folks are stuck. What are you doing for that? It's the same thing we want teachers to do. Principals should be doing at the district level, and the district personnel, their focus should be about getting our principals coached up in the context of collaborative teams.
I love it. And Rhonda's noticing that this is right along the lines of what she was telling me that her district, Pasadena, is doing with principals. I love that so much. And when I was re-listening to the podcast interview that we did, I was struck by a comment that you made about the distinguishing characteristic of true teamwork, of true collaborative work. You said something along the lines of, if our next five collaborative meetings were canceled, could I still get my work done? And if the answer is yes, oh, actually, it'd be better. I could get more work done if our meetings were canceled. If the answer to that is yes, then we might not be dealing with a collaborative team. Help us with that one a little bit. What does it mean for teamwork to truly be interdependent like that and collaborative?
Yeah, and I did a little 2-minute video on that. I'm happy to send you. You can send it out to your folks. But it is, I think we've been doing things the same way for so long that I just try to find ways to shock people into looking at things a little differently. We've been calling teams because we put them together on a list. Right, first grade, four names, and we provide them time to meet, and we give them templates to fill out. But what we forget is how teams really work. And the definition of collaboration, a real team, is when a group of people are brought together, they're working interdependently around a common goal for which they're held mutually accountable. And so that first cog is the one that's missing. It's always missing. We've got the goals. We know we got the SMART goals in place. Specific, measurable, attainable, results oriented, and time bound. I gotcha. And then we also want mutual accountability. We send people to PD for 3 days on iMessages. I need to confront George because he's not bringing his data, but it feels awkward. How do I do it? You know, we do that. But what's missing from all that is interdependence. The reason sports teams work, the reason civic teams work when they're organized the right way is because of what's skin in the game, right? If Justin and I are a team and he's dropping the ball every other week and not making things happen, if it doesn't affect what I have to hand in to the principal or hand in as a product, then you're asking a lot of me to confront him. You're asking a lot of me. Some days I might feel like I can, you know, feel a sense of justice and I feel good about myself. But other days I'm going to sit back and just be annoyed, but get my work done. You see, now, if Justin and I are creating these cups, like this is our end product, and neither one of our families is going to be able to pay the bills unless this is done. And, you know, I create the aluminum part and he creates the top. Well, now you got something different. If he's dropping a ball in our 6-week cycle of creating that mug, you don't have to send me to PD. And I'm not confrontational by nature. I'm a people pleaser. So I'm not telling you it's not going to be uncomfortable. It will be uncomfortable for me. But rest assured, I won't be asking, well, is it admin's a job to confront Justin about not making the tops? When the bottom line is neither one of us is going to get paid if that top and the cup aren't delivered to the vendor together. And so when this is the goal, then we are locked together. We are interdependent. And that's going to take care of a lot of the mutual accountability. That's going to take care of a lot of keeping us on our toes. It also gives us a reason to meet. Like, we got to get this done. So we are compelled to meet. And if I know something about making tops that Justin doesn't know, I'm compelled to share my best practice, because in the end, him making these cups is a win for us. And so how does this translate to schools? When I work with schools and districts, and like I said, coach principals, I organize that interdependent work around essential learning targets. If your fourth grade team goes through a protocol and for the first marking period of the year, they identify 6 skills and competencies that every kid has to know to have any chance of being successful in fourth grade math. Once that's identified, and once we get our heads wrapped around the fact that we're gonna treat these like they're essential, like we're gonna treat these like we're gonna put our backs to the wall and nobody's getting out of here without these, then those 6 become the short-term sense of urgency SMART goal for the quarter. And so the work is, our teams identified 6. Now, 6 is not all we're gonna teach. That's the other part. There are 15 we want to get to, but these are the 6 we got to ensure. Those 6 become our short-term sense of urgency SMART goal. If there are 4 teachers on that team with 25 kids each, that's 100 kids, right? And so our work basically is this. We got 9 weeks to make sure all 100 kids master these 6 targets. How are we going to organize to do that? That's the work. And that short-term sense of urgency SMART goal drives them. And so when they come and meet, every week, all they're doing is monitoring every kid's progress toward mastery of those 6 targets and skills. And therefore, everything they share is in the service of those 6 targets. Every breakthrough they share is in the service of those 6 targets. Every breakdown they suffer is in the service of every kid mastering those 6 targets. And since I can't teach Justin's kids and he can't teach mine, when something's working, right? And Heather's got kids too. Once something's working for us, it's not about, oh, I want to keep this to myself. I'm compelled to share, because the other rub is, as a principal, I went from, you never get away from looking at individual teacher data, but when we share data as a staff, I shared it as team data. And that was a game changer at our school. And so fourth grade data went up on the wall instead of just individual teacher data. And that also compelled us to reach out for help and to offer best practice when you need it. Without interdependence, you're pushing jello up a hill, you're pulling teeth. I don't blame teachers for thinking about the 10 other things they could be doing, because we lean too much on the moral imperative. We think that because we're here for noble reasons, that's enough for people to meet the right way. I like to appeal to human nature, and human nature says, if Justin creating these tops is in my best interest and affects my bread, my bottom line, I'm compelled to help Justin. Yes, and I love kids. Yes, and I want our school to be great. But the real bottom line is, what he does affects my bottom line. What I do affects his bottom line. Therefore, we are interdependent. And that's a huge missing link from teams. We want teams to come together because we do great things for kids, and that's not enough.
Powerful. The whole idea of collective responsibility, I think, is such a, I mean, honestly, a strange one to our profession. I think, it's almost sacrosanct, this idea that there's a rectangle full of children here with one teacher and a rectangle next door with a different teacher and different students. And for most purposes, we treat them as completely separate units. And certainly we treat schools as separate units. But at the level of leadership, we know we are accountable collectively. We're, the principal of the school is accountable for the results of every classroom. The superintendent is accountable for the results of every school. The assistant superintendent is accountable for the results of every school that they supervise. And making that collective accountability a reality for more than just one person, more than just the leader who can, maybe be replaced if the results aren't where they need to be. That seems to me to be the big challenge that you're hitting on here, that we have to make sure that accountability is owned, that responsibility is owned, that mission is shared, because otherwise the meeting is just kind of, yeah, potentially a waste of time, that I'm here and I have to pretend to collaborate with you, but then we're going to go do our own separate things. Right. And I appreciate that can happen at either the classroom level, with teachers or with principals among schools. Take us into that. So go ahead. You were going to jump back in.
So the way I characterize collective responsibility, when I do work with schools, I use a movie clip from the movie Coach Carter, and all the basketball players signed a contract to say their grades need to be here or we're not going to play. They looked up, it was the end of the semester, and their grades were horrible. Coach Carter locked the gym. That's accountability. And, we feel bad for the players, but they didn't meet the terms of the contract. Then Coach Carter said, now, moving forward, I've got these three teachers over here, these three teachers who have volunteered to work with us on a weekly basis to check in and make sure our grades are where they need to be. So next progress report, next quarter, at this time, we're not going to have this problem. Does that make sense? So that's when he moved from accountability to collective responsibility. Accountability, again, is locking the gym. Collective responsibility is, yes, lock the gym, but I'm taking responsibility as well. I'm going to set us up with tutors. I'm going to ensure we're never here again. And that's the difference. It's one thing to offer students the opportunity to learn. It's another thing to ensure they learn. And so, and this is especially important at the secondary level, where it's a lot of sink or swim, or getting kids ready for the real world, and all those things. It doesn't change. It doesn't change. When you treat essentials like they are essential, collective responsibility is embedded in that process. Because you're going to have students who want to opt out, who don't really understand why they must learn it yet. And it's the same thing with adults, by the way. You have teachers who want to opt out of best practice. They're not sure about the protocol. But I know better. See, I know that our data is going to be better analyzed through a really good data protocol. And even when I have folks who resist or are afraid and don't want to try it, or they may be perfectionists and don't want to make mistakes, I know better than to let them opt out. I got to see around corners for them. So the collective responsibility there is to not settle for, oh, well, 5 out of 6 of my teams are doing it. No, I need 6 of 6 doing it. Even if the 6th team is doing it in a raggedy way to start, I need everybody working. And so collective responsibility is when you decide to really ensure kids learn, collective responsibility will be a part of it, because you'll be in rooms like, okay, Justin didn't get it, or Justin is, it's not sinking in here. What are we going to do? Okay, who's got an idea? Who's got this? Who's got that? Who's got this? Or, Justin's being a little obstinate. He's trying to opt out. Well, maybe our personalities are bumping. Who's got something? Oh, you know what? I'm good. I connect with Justin pretty well. We talk in the cafe. It's that kind of, we're going to find a way. Like, Justin thinks he's going to be able to opt out of this, but we're not going to allow it. We're going to set up the conditions to ensure he learns. When we decide to ensure kids learn, as opposed to simply give them the opportunity to learn, collective responsibility takes care of itself, if that makes sense. So it's not coddling. It's not being soft. It's deciding that these things are so important that we can't allow you to opt out. And so I'm going to try to find ways to make it fun, to make it connect with you, to make it and get whatever I need to do. That's what collective responsibility is. It's simple to understand, not easy to do. Simply flipping on the switch and treating essentials like they're essential. When you treat something like it's essential, the example I use all the time is like moms and their first baby. That first baby, the baby you make everybody scrub into the elbow before they can touch your baby, like it's like they're on Grey's Anatomy, right? The baby, you would never pick a Cheeto up off the floor and give it to that baby. Second baby, 5 second rule. The first baby, never. You got 5,000 pictures of the first baby, 500 of the second baby. When a mama needs something to happen for that baby and the odds are stacked against her, you see it. Your wife has done it. My wife has done it. Get out of the way.
It's going to happen. Like
a second. Get out of the way because they're going to make it happen. And sometimes they're not going to be explained how they made it happen. There was just no option but to make it happen. When you can't treat every standard, you can't treat every target in the curriculum like that. But there are a handful that we must treat like that. And when we do that, collective responsibility takes care of itself because we have a mindset that no kid can walk out without. And if they finish the year and they're still a little bit behind, I promise you, they're going to be a lot further than they ever would have been, right? Just kind of going about it and offering them the opportunity. That makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, I know a lot of the book is about mission, vision, values, and goals. And as you put it, the aligning around the why, the I, the how, and the now. I don't want to be selfish here and take up all the time with my own questions, which I could definitely do. So I'm going to turn it over to Heather to take it from here. Heather?
Hey, thanks, Justin. This is a great conversation. I love the book. So practical and so energizing in all pieces of this work. My question was around mission, vision, values, goals, and our district's been deep into that for a while. They would talk about values being those collective commitments that we're willing to make to see the mission and vision through. You talked a little bit differently about collective commitments earlier in this conversation. Yeah. Is that just semantics or is there a difference? I felt like the collective commitments you were chatting about were a little bit more specific to teams, that kind of thing. Can you just clarify that a bit?
I sure can. I think just like there, you know, there were two different contexts for compliance, right? The compliance of new learning versus the compliance of why are we doing this. There are also different contexts for collective commitments. You know, there's some collective commitments that are about the heart. We're here for kids. We're going to do what we need to do for kids. You know, we're going to make every kid feel seen and heard and make, you know, those kinds of commitments. We're here to, you know, we want to make sure they walk. I call them like powerful but ambiguous commitments, which are fine and they have their place. What I do, and it's not a good or bad thing, right or wrong thing, I cut to the quick, I cut to the work. The collective commitments I talk about are the work because I find a lot of districts can get caught up in, you know, ready, aim, you got to fire. And so I'm an advocate of getting out there and making a mess. And so once we got that why in place, what you want school to provide your child, the next collective commitments, we don't talk about the work. You need to be organized in collaborative teams. As principal, we need to make sure that there is time built into the schedule, into their duty day to collaborate. If we say it's important, then it should be important enough to work into their duty day schedule. They shouldn't have to do it after school or on their own time. We need to identify what every student must know and be able to do. That's collective commitment. We must figure out whether they got it or not based on the work of common assessments. Right. We must then also commit to using that common assessment data to improve our practice. It's not just to figure out which kids got and which kids didn't. It's also to improve our practice. And then we commit to take the results of that common assessment and do something, take action in real time and immediately to both accelerate students who are behind and enrich and extend kids who have mastered the content. And so I like to get to the work because, again, the heartfelt collective commitments, that'll take care of itself. I want to get folks working. I want to get our hands on the work, because the buy-in we all want as leaders, superintendents, assistant supes, and principals, the buy-in we want, we think it's going to happen by bringing a speaker in, by showing data, by studying together, by doing a book study. That all sets the table. But buy-in truly occurs when people get new, when they have new experiences and get new results. I had 1,000 people tell me that doing a tune-up on my car is going to be easy. I still open the hood of that old car and it scared the hell out of me every time. It wasn't until I put my hands on it that, you know what, now I'm bought in, now I can do it again. And so that's why the collective commitments I talk about get folks doing the work, get them working, because they need to get results. That's where they're going to buy in. And so again, that's another revision I would make. And starting a movement too, I would definitely hone in on, hey, let's start working.
Thank you. That's great. Appreciate that.
It's a great question.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you, Heather, for
you and Heather got a brother sweating. I'm gonna turn my, I didn't even turn a fan on over my head. Hang on.
Good deal. All right. So whoever else would like to ask a question of Ken, if you have a scenario, I would love to hear your scenario. Feel free to let me know or raise your hand, and I can make you a panelist and you can ask your question directly. I will take up all of our time with my own questions, but I want to make sure we get to your questions and your scenarios. I'll put that out there. Let me know if you're willing to ask a question, to share from your context. And in the meantime, Ken, I wanted to ask about I'll handle the chat, and I'll put people on camera just like Heather was. You don't have to worry about the chat. I wanted to ask about a scenario that many of our principal supervisor members might be in, where you have these kind of, I don't want to say necessarily turf wars between schools, but there's this kind of, you know, principal to principal, there's this kind of posturing and, you know, playing defense a little bit that I think makes it difficult for principals to engage in truly collective commitment, because, you know, we want to make sure that, well, our demographics don't shift too much because we might not be able to handle that. We want to make sure that our funding doesn't get cut. We want to make sure that nobody steals our teachers, and that if we try to pass off a teacher we're trying to get rid of on somebody else, that they don't, you know, put up too much of a fight. Like there's this kind of standoff a little bit between principals. And I have to say, all of my colleagues in Seattle that I worked with were wonderful. So I definitely don't have like a villain in mind here. But I just think the principalship creates this kind of, kind of feudal system where I've got my territory, you've got your territory. And if you're the principal supervisor, how do you work past some of that territoriality or those kind of fiefdoms that we set up for ourselves?
So a lot of those fiefdoms used to be teachers, right? Teachers that didn't want to share practice, I'm going to keep my cards close to the vest, or even teams, I'm going to keep my cards close to the vest. And what you have there is, and I'm telling you up front, you can't see all my shelving and stuff, but I'm a big sports fan, and I love competition, and I don't believe in everybody getting a trophy. I don't believe in any of that. There are wins and losses, and I love kicking butt. However, there is healthy competition, and then there's unhealthy competition. Now, I should talk like I'm walking and living a higher purpose, but I'm not. I don't mind looking at the district next door and kicking their butt. I don't mind that. But within district, we can't be competitive with one another. And so if that's happening at the district level, then as a superintendent or assistant superintendent, I'm going to ask myself, what have I done or not done to cause the situation? What have I said or not said to cause the situation? What have I confronted or not confronted to cause the situation? If it's happening at the school level, I'm going to ask the same questions. What have I said or not said? What can I put in place to make sure teams are sharing? What have I done? Am I pitting teams against one another? Am I creating these contests where there's just one winner? You know, you don't, that's, You don't want that kind of competition. You don't want what Alfie Cohn would call consequential competition in a place where we want all kids, we want everybody to thrive. Because once you put consequential competition in place, like the team that improves the most will, you know, get these rewards, whatever they are, then I'm not incented to share some of my best practice with you because, you know, I need to finish in first place. And it's the same at the district level. And so I worked with a district outside Phoenix a few years ago. And man, we would have these awkward silences after a while. I'd ask some really reflective questions. And then I'm an elephant in the room guy. And so I just asked, you know, there's an energy in here. I'm feeling it. I know it's not me. So what is it? And they finally fessed up and talked about how the schools compete against one another within the district. And we spent the rest of the morning just talking about how self-destructive that is in the service of your school, of your district vision, how unhealthy it is in the service of your district vision. Now, again, if you want to kick the district next door, it's probably not the right thing to do. I should probably read some spiritual book and say we should all thrive, but I'm good with that. Them, right? We want to be the shining star of the Phoenix area. I'm good with that, but not within district. Like we've got to, and so that's where I think about, as a principal, making sure my teams were interdependent. So there wasn't one teacher holding his best practice back to look best on the team. I had that. I also had a teacher holding back his best practice only because he's super old school and he'd give it to you if you asked, but there were such new teachers on his team, they didn't know sometimes what they didn't know. But when I put their team data up, that was the last day he was ever hesitant. Next 3 weeks, he's holding court. He got three new teachers, a 35-year vet. He's holding court and making that stuff happen. And so we not only need to get back to talking about we are one team, but then we got to embed processes that will encourage it. So again, one way to get away from teacher isolation is to have them in real, effective, collaborative teams. One way to get away from school fiefdoms, administrative fiefdoms, is to have them in collaborative teams working on interdependent goals where they have to meet each other and each other's progress is in their best interests. Principal teams can be interdependent as well. And that's how you work around it. But you got to talk about the elephant in the room. And if you're a district leader and, you know, our talk here is making you realize that, oh, you know what, maybe I've been fostering unhealthy competition. Say it, fall on the sword, talk about what you learned, and move forward. But that's almost always the root, right? As the superintendent, one of the assistant supes in Fulton County said, he said, we are, sometimes I feel like we're not a school district, but a district of schools. And the only way to move that forward is to bring folks together interdependently, lock them together so that they're gonna share best practice and help each other grow because it's in their own best interest. But you gotta acknowledge it first. If that's part of the energy in your district, acknowledge it. I mean, we're a competitive country, so it's not a crime that it spills in. We just have to temper it and make sure it's not consequential competition. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense. And I think the when that commitment is there, we have the opportunity to go beyond the boasting, to go beyond the show us the highlights reel of your school. And I was talking with with an assistant superintendent earlier today about learning walks and district learning rounds and just the power of getting principals to get into each other's schools. And yet we've got to deal with that, right? That that tendency to just kind of show off and let me take you to the classrooms I'm most proud of and avoid certain other classrooms. And Heather asked an interesting question here.
That's why I'm a huge advocate of folks working in collaborative teams because, like you said, learning walks, we can get a lot out of this classroom. That's great. But when we are meeting on a week-to-week basis, or principals are accountable to each other for deliverables on a bi-monthly or monthly basis. The dog and pony show can go, but so far you're going to see everyone, warts and all. It's going to show, and that's what you want, right? That's what you want. When it's only once in a while, yeah. People ask me, like, what's your favorite Wu-Tang album? And my answer is, the best of Wu-Tang. My favorite Tribe Called Quest album is the best of Tribe Called Quest. My favorite Earth, Wind & Fire, the best of the Bee Gees, the best of, because of the 300 songs they sang, you cherry pick the best 25 and put them there. And so we got to get past that. And so locking folks together is so key. All right, I'm sorry to interrupt that.
Very well said. Go ahead, Heather.
Thanks. In the last chapter, sort of jumping ahead toward the end, the very end of the book, you talk lots about stories and celebrations. And I loved the example of the first 72 hours of school and building relationships, all those kinds of things. In our setting here, my vice principal and I got some feedback that staff weren't feeling appreciated. They weren't feeling equally appreciated. They were feeling like some people were getting thanked and others weren't. So we've talked to our core leadership team. We've set about to make sure that there's lots of places, systems in place to make sure that we're not missing anything. We've got staff appreciating one another, all that kind of thing. As we try to move from appreciation as a thing to that aligned celebration, like celebrations that align with what we say we're about, what kind of advice do you have for moving? Not that we're not going to do those other appreciation things, but how do we move that needle to more aligned that you talk about at the end of the book?
Listen, to me, they can be one and the same. To me, the only thing you may separate are engaged last week. Justin caught the biggest fish outside Seattle and then Utah, whatever. Like, that kind of celebration is one thing, but the aligned celebration. So you hit on something important. You have staff celebrating each other. One teacher told me that some student told him, you know, this lesson is boring. And so he opened up his planning book and he said, come on up here, fix it. Tell me what you want. And I love that. So I love that you're empowering staff. Celebration can start with administration, start with you and your assistant principal. It can't stay with you. You'll always celebrate, but get them celebrating each other, right? So that's one. Two, I'm writing a book and I just wrote a little section called Crabs in a Barrel. And here's the reality. There are some days where we would all love, you know what crabs in a barrel means? It means, you know, sometimes we talk a lot about bullying and bullying and kids bullying, but adults, we can bully the hell out of one another. Heather pipes up and does something well, and I recognize them. We're often like, well, look at her. Who does she think she is? Go ahead and keep brown nosing, Heather. Oh, Heather's trying to be the principal's pet. And then how do you feel? You're like, well, I don't want to poke my head up and be recognized anymore. So you got to work through that and know that that's coming, right? So that's one. Two, make sure to celebrate each other. Three, in terms of aligned celebration, you want to think about celebration this way. Think about behaviors and practices you want to see everyone do. That's what you want to celebrate, because the right folks with the right wiring, like me, when you celebrate Justin's team and we are just short of that, my butt's going to burn and I want some of what he got. And the only way to get it is to do it, right? Because you're celebrating practice. Now, if it's, oh, Justin, you know, say, you know, something ambiguous, like they're so nice. I mean, that's great, but you want to celebrate behaviors you want to see done over and over again, because when that's done in a healthy way, one, Justin's team is going to be apt to do it over and over again. That's what human beings do once we're recognized and celebrated. And two, you can't lose sleep over the fact that, well, Justin's team got celebrated, but other teams didn't, and other teams didn't get stuck till, and she didn't recognize that stuck till, blah, blah. That's what adult tantruming, Heather. Don't do that. I love my principal. One of the things he did was he went and then he tried to check off, just, you got a nice button on your shirt. And Heather, you did well. And B. Travers, I like the color of your vest today. Like, don't be inauthentic. Keep it to practice. And if other folks want that shine, they'll do it. They'll do it, and you notice it, and then we celebrate it. You want to celebrate, and you can have a lot of fun with it. Have fun with it. Don't make it stale and boring. Have fun with it, but celebrate those behaviors and practices you want to see done consistently. Early on, they're probably going to be small, just like small victories, right? But then 3 or 4 months later, you got to ratchet it up and go from, hey, this team's meeting, they met, they're meeting consistently and talking about kids, to boom, this team is using a data protocol, and they went from using that data protocol to snapping their kids into flexible regrouping situations, you know? So you want to ratchet up the expectations, but always keep in mind, we're celebrating because I want to see that done over and over again. If you got kids, when you give your kids a compliment, it's because you want to see them, you want them to do that again. You're rewarding them. And so don't be afraid of, if you got six teams, two of the teams are making it happen based on expectation, and you recognize them, and the other four are going to try to mean girl you a little bit. That's all right. That's all right. That's a part of it, right? What principals do too often is they're like, oh, wait, I do appreciate it. And then they go back, well, I have an amendment. I'm going to make sure the other four teams, blah, blah. No. Make them earn it. They're not going to love you every day. It's okay.
Okay.
Card game is going to take a hit when you operate this way. It's all right. Your gift card can do this.
Awesome. Thank you. You're on the right track.
I love it. Yeah, and it strikes me as a great example of getting people to complain about the right things, right? Like, there are certain complaints, you're glad to hear that. Like, oh, people are complaining that they're not being recognized for not helping with our core mission. Okay, well, I'm glad that they're upset about that, frankly. So, love it. Love it. Well, I know we've got to wrap up here, Ken. If people want to get more Ken Williams in their school district or follow along with what you're doing, where's the best place for them to go to find out more about your work, to follow you, to get in touch, reach out to you about doing some work?
That's a great question. UnfoldTheSoul.com is a place you can go, and you can follow me. My goal for the last couple of weeks has been to drop a video a day, just offer some value and ask for nothing. And so I've been dropping one on a daily basis. I apologize, hang on a second. And so you can find it. Can I screen share for just a sec?
Yeah.
All right, hang on a sec. I'm not all tech savvy like you are, my friend. Hold on, I got this. Okay. Let me try this. All right, so share.
Yep, there it goes.
All right. And I can send you that JPEG, and you want to send that out to folks, but that's the best way to get in touch with me, whether it's, you know, you're interested in training and coaching, speaking, or if you know someone who might, you know, benefit from my messaging, or if you just want to follow and, you know, take in these little videos, that's like, I don't do a whole lot else on social media, but those little videos with your help, Justin, I've kind of found my groove, so.
Yeah. I love those videos.
To connect with you.
Yeah, I love seeing those videos come up. Every time I see the cowboy hat in my newsfeed, I stop and watch. So keep an eye out for those, everyone. And Ken, well, best wishes as you put together the new book. Can't wait to hear more about that when the time comes. And thank you so much for your time today. This has been a pleasure and a recharge. And just want to thank you for joining us on the roundtable.
Well, I love your work. I love what you're doing. I love your mission. I've been following you for maybe almost a decade. So I appreciate this opportunity. It was an honor. And thank you to all the folks who plugged in today.
Well, likewise all around. And we had a couple people who had to leave early. They said this was amazing. Let's see. couple of people, Rhonda had to go and said, this is great and thank you. Let's see. Kirsten says, thank you. Love listening to Ken. Shelley says, this is great. Brian says, thank you. And I got, again, lots of other strongly pro Ken Williams messages. So very honored to have you here today.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone. We will send you the recording as soon as possible. And I hope you've enjoyed this. If you haven't listened to the podcast with Ken on his book, Starting a Movement, check your email. I'm sure I've emailed you about that 3 or 4 times. So you'll find the link to the podcast there. Definitely worth a listen. And we'll talk soon. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.